As we open up our scriptures to Exodus chapter 2, I just want to think about what took place last week and just slightly review so that we don't step into tonight's lesson without thinking about our context. Israel is where? Egypt, right? And what is going on with Israel? If you could describe what's going on with the people of Israel, what would you say? How would you describe it? And as long as it stays within the context, oh yes, they're spreading, right? They're swarming like bugs is the way it describes it in the text. They're multiplying very rapidly. But as they multiply, what type of conditions do they live in? Slavery, and it's cruel. It's heartbreaking. And Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt, what is he trying to do to them? He's trying to kill them off, right? Yeah, he's trying to reduce the population because he fears their population growth and their strength and that they might join with the enemy. And if they did that, they might actually leave and he would lose his slave labor. And so he tries to impose a few ways of population control. The first one is, let's make their tasks harder. Does that work out successfully? He says, let's deal shrewdly with them, but I don't know what his definition of shrewd is, do you? Because it didn't work very well, that's for sure. And so that was a failure. Israel continues to multiply. And then what happens after that? What's his second policy of population control? Kill the babies, the firstborn sons. And he tells the midwives, of whom they're named, right? Do you remember their names? Yes, Hebrew names. But it's significant that these ladies are named because they're that important. Do they obey Pharaoh's instruction, command to kill the baby boys? No. Now, how does God deal with these ladies that disobey the king's command? He blesses them, doesn't he? He gives them families. They feared God more than they feared the greatest king on the earth. May our hearts do the same. Pharaoh says, I want to instill a third policy of population control. And what does he command at the end of chapter 1? Throw the boys in the river. What about the girls? Just let me mention that. He says, let them live, right? Does he seem concerned with the females? Why is that, I wonder? Why do you think he points at the writer of Exodus, Moses? Why do you think he points that out? Let the girls live. Men cause problems? Yeah, he feared the men of Israel, right? And he feared what they might do, if the uprising or whatever. I think it's very important. Already, we have two people who are named in the text, and nobody else. Who are the two people? The ladies. They're already saving the day, aren't they? And let us look, as we go through chapter 2, who is it that works to bring about the deliverer? He's not concerned with the ladies. Maybe he should be. And that brings us to Exodus chapter 2. Now, I want to remind us that this is an open forum. So if you have a question, you ask, because we want to talk about it here. But Exodus chapter 2, now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. Now, what decree has Pharaoh issued in the context for the birth of Moses? We already talked about that. The sons must be thrown into the Nile, and who may live? The daughters. Does Pharaoh perceive any danger from them? No, should he? Now, let me ask, what do we know concerning Levi and his tribe up to this point? So if we were thinking through Genesis, and I had to go back and look myself, like, what has been said about Levi up to this point? Because the writer of Exodus, Moses, expects us to know what has happened already. What has happened with Levi up to this point? The first thing that comes to your mind, right? Oh, well, they're the priest and the assistants of the priest, right? But that hasn't happened yet, has it? The law has not yet been established. Levi has not yet been set apart as a priestly tribe. So up to this point in the narrative, what has happened in Genesis chapter 34, Do you remember Dinah and Shechem and Hamor, and then Simeon and Levi go in and destroy a city out of their vengeance for the honor of their sister Dinah? And so Levi has, along with his brother Simeon, he's zealous, full of this wrath and anger and rage. So that's Exodus chapter 34. Also, Levi is mentioned in Genesis chapter 34. And also, he's mentioned in Genesis chapter 49 when Jacob, that is Israel, is blessing his children. Now, I want you to, you can just turn it back a page, Genesis 49, verses 5 and 7. Look what he says about his sons. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. A little bit of divine foreshadowing of what will happen with Levi. Levi will not have an inheritance with the rest of the tribes. They will be scattered throughout all of Israel as ministers to the people of Israel. And here we see that that stems from their anger, which they demonstrated there in Genesis chapter 34. Very interesting. But here we have Exodus chapter 2. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took his wife, a Levite woman. So I think it's important to know what has come to Levi and what will come from Levi. And that's why the author mentions it here, so that we know that this baby is a Levite. This one is going to be a Levite. All that to say is such a simple point, right? Exodus chapter 2, verse 2. The woman conceived and bore a son, and then she saw that he was a fine child, and she hid him 3 months. So here we have, does Moses' mother comply with Pharaoh's command? She does not, does she? Once again, a lady not complying to the command of Pharaoh the king. How does the Bible describe the birth and preservation of Moses? So he's conceived and bore a son. Very, very simple logical steps. To a man and a woman come together. The woman conceives and she bears a son. And then what does the text say? I like to hear your different translations. So, Fred, would you mind reading that for me? The second verse. Yes. Goodly child. And this translation, the ESV, has a fine child. Any other different words? Beautiful, right? Beautiful child. That language is interesting. So you read that and you say to yourself, well, did she see the child and say, oh, that's beautiful, so let me not do something, as if she would do something before? No. The language there is very interesting. Fine, beautiful. The Hebrew word is tov, which is good. And the construction of that phrase is parallel to the same thing that we hear when God created the earth and he called it good. It's the same construction. And he looked and he saw that it was good. So here, I'm going to have a quote from a commentary. It says, and God saw that it was good. See, it's Benjamin Jacob, and he says this: she looked upon her child with a joy similar to that of God upon his creation. So when she saw the child, and she saw the image of God in that child, so she held that baby for the first time in her arms, and she saw him and thought about what it is, what was the thing that happened in her heart. Oh, that's so good. Divine goodness. And what follows this beauty and this joy of seeing this child? It's interesting because she hid him for 3 months, right? And I was thinking about that because we have a four-month-old in the house, right? And I'm thinking to myself, well, why was it 3 months? I don't know why. And the text doesn't tell us, but she concealed this baby as long as she could. As long as she could, until she could do it no longer. She had no intention in complying with Pharaoh's command. And so what we read here out is very different than what Pharaoh commanded. He said, every son that is born to the Hebrews shall be cast into the Nile River. And she, after she could hide them no longer, does what? She took a basket. And then she took that basket and she covered it with, I have what it's called, daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She waterproofed it. We would line it with plastic or put some ceiling on it or something like that. But she made a waterproof a basket. Now, here's a interesting thing. The word basket is only used for one other item in Hebrew. Do you know what it is? I thought it was so fascinating. Who said that? You did. Oh, I was like, the ark. That's the only other usage of this word in the Old Testament. Ark. What did the ark do? Here Moses is placed in we call it a mini ark, won't we? The mini ark, he's placed inside of it. So that is verse 3. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket, a mini ark made of bulrushes or papyrus, and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. And what did she do? She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. She put it in a place in which it wouldn't float away. She gently places this among the reeds instead of casting the child out in the middle of the Nile. She has intention, doesn't she? This baby boy of mine, no, I will not do what Pharaoh commanded. I won't kill this boy. And so we see in verse 4, we know for sure that she intended something, or she... maybe she hoped and prayed that something would happen, and his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. It's so interesting. Here she is, Moses' sister, stands at a distance as that little basket is in the Nile, or maybe a tributary of the Nile, among the reeds, just sitting there, just waiting. What's going to happen? And what happens? The first question, number 4, who comes to the river? When you see something like this as you're going through a narrative, now a disjunctive, now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, we should never think that that is mere coincidence. that baby is in that river at that time and those reeds, and it just so happens that Pharaoh's daughter comes by the river. Oh, no. There is somebody at work here. It is the sovereign hand of God at work, directing his salvation for his people in a little tiny stream next to the Nile here in the papyrus. That's how he works in our hearts and lives. One little thing, one meeting will change your life forever sometimes. God's hand of providence working through history and events to bring about his salvation. That's exactly right. I couldn't say it any better myself. Why did she come? Well, who comes? I don't even think I said it right. Who comes? The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. Providence of God in daily life, in the mundane, for his glory. So it seems as if, I think this is the picture that the text is trying to draw. She actually comes down to wash herself. And as she does that, she has a royal entourage with her. And as she's washing herself, her, I don't know a better way to say it, her maidens, or those who are with her, they walk away to give her privacy. You see that in the text there. It says, now the daughter of the Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and while her young women walked beside the river. I think that's the picture that's being painted. So they're walking away, and while they're walking away, And this is two different Hebrew words here. So these young women are walking away, and she saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her servant. So the word for young ladies is different from the word for servant there. So it seems like she has multiple ones, and this servant, more like a maybe even a slave, was there helping and assisting her where her young ladies were walking away, and she tells her servant, go get that basket in the reeds. So the servant complies, and she sent her servant, and then the Hebrew gets real, I don't know what you would say, punchy here, like events, just like this. It's sort of like this. It says, she looked, and she opened, and she, or it says, she took it, and she opened it, and she saw, and then it changes. So she takes the basket, takes it, and looks, she opens, and then we get to look in with her. You see how the language changes? Behold, there was a baby crying, and she took pity on him and said, the language is so beautiful here. She takes a basket, looks at it, holds it, and opens, and we see the lid of the basket, however it was constructed, and behold, there's a baby crying. And what happens? Her heart just, whew, I'm not going to throw the baby in the river either. I think that's what she's thinking. I can't kill this. What does she say? She says, this is one of the Hebrews' children. She knew from day one what was happening here. We don't know who exactly this Pharaoh's daughter is. There's some conjecture about it, but we don't know. We don't have to know to see the picture, do we? Her heart, she was brought to the river by God, and her heart was softened as she saw that little baby in that basket, heard it crying. She has compassion. She took pity on one of the Hebrews' children. Who is it, again, that did that? Pharaoh's daughter. Who did she send to go get the basket? The female slave. Have we seen any boys, except for this young boy in the basket who seems to be helpless at this time, in here? No. Should Pharaoh have been concerned with these ladies? I think he might have been, should have been concerned with them. We should never underestimate the significance of ladies in our hearts and our lives. How is the necessity of feeding an infant resolved? I love this, don't you? Well, here she is. Like, there's a baby crying, and I always talk about the big three, right? If a baby's crying, there's three things I like to check. The diaper, the sleepiness, and the stomach. At this point in time, you know, she might, let's say that she checked the big three, right? Let's make sure it's clean. It's sleepy. Obviously, it's not sleeping. It's in the basket. Well, it might be hungry, and I can't do anything about it. So what are we going to do? Well, let us look. Verse 7. Then his sister, who had been standing at a distance to see what happens, said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call to you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? And the answer, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the girl went and did what? Called the child's mother. I love it, don't you? Like a big circle. I give it away, Lord, and you bring him right back to me. Sometimes he just needs to know that you're willing to obey, and he'll bring it back to you. And so Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you wages. Now she gets paid for feeding her own baby. I love it, don't you? The Lord is so good in this way. So the woman took the child and nursed him. And when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So this son, after it gets to, let's say, weaning age, is brought to Pharaoh's daughter and becomes the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And she named him Moses because, she said, I drew him out of the water. The Hebrew word for draw out is similar to Moses. But we have something else going on here, something very significant. I want you to think about this. Who names Moses? Now, was she speaking Hebrew? Probably not, right? Probably not. So there is an Egyptian word similar to Moses. It's like Mo or Meh, and that's probably what she named him, which means to be born or to live. And so she probably did that and named him that. You'll hear it in some of the Pharaoh's names, I can't even think of them right now. But you'll see that little word in there. It means to be born or to live. So what's going on here? So Moses means to draw out of the water. Draw out of the water. What will Moses do by God's hand of providence? The nation of Israel in Egypt. And how will they leave Egypt? They'll come through the Red Sea. So I think what is going on here is a wordplay and a foreshadowing of who Moses is. So the implication for the Israelites is something to this effect. You called him born one in your language after your custom, but in our language that name means drawing out, which is what was to become of him. You drew him out of the water, but he would draw us out of Egypt through the water. God is so good, isn't he? Even in the naming of a child, God is so good here with Moses. So there's something in there when she hears that baby cry and sees that baby in that basket, she knows, even though her father has commanded that these sons be killed, she knows that's not right, is it? I know. So I think there's an intrinsic knowledge within our hearts that life is precious. It needs to be preserved. And when you look at that baby, you know it would be wrong to destroy it. There is a lot of thought about that, but it was death that was supposed to come upon them. How? It could be exposure. It could be in various different ways, but that was the intention, because we see Pharaoh trying to control population, kill these babies. The means of which here is in the Nile, but obviously the third attempt to control population will result in the deliverance of Israel. The very thing that he didn't want to happen, this is the one that will deliver them. Isn't that so interesting? So let's push on that just a little bit more. So let me see if I can summarize your thought well. It's like, it seems as if something is going on here to protect this baby. Would you think that's correct? Yes. Why is that? What is it? He has a plan, right? And he's using this text to show us that from the very conception and then the birth of this boy, God has a plan for him. I think you're right. I think you are feeling the pulse of the Hebrew author, Moses, as he writes this text. He wants us to see God's hand here in the midst of this. Which brings us to the next section. I think it's very, very insightful. In fact, this section, Moses tries to take upon himself the mantle of deliverer, and it utterly fails. You can't do this apart from God. And I think that's the whole point of this text, this particular text, show that God is in control here, and then yet Moses is going to try to take up this mantle himself and utterly fail, and then God will actually rescue his people through Moses. Moses won't do it on his own. One day, verse 11, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. Now, you see how we have shifted in time significantly? Like now, he's a full-blown adult man in just one verse like that. Moses flees to Midian. What is the first act in the Bible that the Bible records about Moses? It's the very first thing that the Bible records about this man. What is it? He kills somebody. Moses' first act is that he kills an Egyptian. One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. So he identifies with this already. And he looked this way and that. He looks before, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian, and then he hit him in the sand. He looks both ways, nobody's around, he kills him, and then he hides the evidence. The very first act of Moses is that he kills a man. That's interesting, isn't it? Why does God use this man who killed another man to deliver his people? You ever think about that? If we saw that on his record, we probably would say what? Now we'll probably pass over him. Sometimes we have heroes of the faith. But you think about them just for a second. Think about Abraham, who went down into Egypt. What did he do? He lied a couple of times about it. He wasn't very faithful. Took his handmaiden to have a promise fulfilled. Think about Moses, who kills the Egyptian. Well, let's go on a little further. Who else can we think about? Well, let's think about David. What did David do? Not much better, is it? Yeah. Yeah. Think about these people who God uses in great ways and who we would call in Sunday school heroes. But who are they? They are sinners. Broken people. Just like us. There's a lesson there, I think, to be learned. That the heroes are not really heroes, but grace has saved from the beginning all the way to the end. We're not perfect. And the Bible is a true because it records. Do you think if somebody was not trying to record actual truth that they would actually put in that Moses was a murderer? No. But this is God's word. It is true. What we'll do is we'll step through three circumstances that Moses enters. This one, an argument between two Hebrews, and then an episode at a well. And every time, he's trying to stand up for what is right. So we see this character of righteousness that's in him, but executed in a very wrong way. The Lord says, vengeance is mine, not somebody else's. We cannot take personal vengeance into our own hands. That is wrong. And here, Moses learns that lesson. Verse 13. When he went out the next day, so that happened the day before, he went out, he goes out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, so very specifically, he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? And what's the answer? Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Let's stop right there. Who made you a prince and a judge over us? And what's the answer to that question? Not yet, though, right? Nobody has yet. This is another foreshadowing. Another foreshadowing. What's going on? Who made you prince and judge over us? Nobody. Yet. But it will happen. But not yet. Not in your way. It's interesting that you note that, because he is already identifying with his people here, right? And maybe from the young age, he knew who he was, and I think he did. And then he grows up in the court of Pharaoh, and maybe just like the daughter of Pharaoh, he could see the injustices that was being done upon the people of Israel. And he said to himself, one day, I'm going to do something about it. And he tries.
Just started still.
That is, maybe it's God's amazing grace already at work in his heart. What do you say? Yes. It's so interesting that it jumps from verse 10 to 11, and then decades go by, right? It is sort of silent, but that's okay. Why is that okay? Because the text will lead us to where we need to be. I'm so thankful for that. I'm so thankful for that. So, what happens the next day? We've already covered that. Hebrew versus Hebrew. And this, he says, the guilty man responds, who made you judge over us? No one yet. And then what happens next? What does he say? Are you going to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And can you imagine the look on his face when he said that? It all comes out, doesn't it? Sooner in his case, the next day, right? Maybe it's better to be sooner rather than later. Yeah. But when he said that, are you gonna kill me like you did him? And he could just, all the color goes out of his face. And he's like, this is not going to be good. So what does he do? Then Moses, it says it, he was afraid. And then we get to hear his thoughts and this his internal dialogue. Remember, this is direct speech here, so these slowed us down. It's very important. Surely the thing is known. What thing? The thing. It doesn't even have to say it, does it? The thing is known. I killed a man. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now that word sat down can also mean dwell or live by, which I think is probably the way it should be translated, because we'll see that word pop up again in the narrative, and it means to live and to dwell. Shuv is the Hebrew word, but to dwell or to be by a well. So what happens? Moses flees to Midian. Midian is most likely to the east of Egypt. We don't know exactly where it is or if it was just a nomadic tribe in the area, but it was outside of Pharaoh's reach, outside of his control, and that's where he flees, and he sits down by a well. Now, have we seen wells already yet in the narrative, maybe including Genesis as well? Yeah, things happen at wells. A lot of things happen at wells, and that's important for the literature purposes to connect Exodus back to Genesis. Something else is going to happen at a well. Now, Moses remains in Midian. How does Moses become acquainted with the priest of Midian and his family? The priest of Midian has 7 daughters. Note that this is, once again, before the giving of the law. The only other priest like this has been mentioned is Melchizedek. And he was a priest and a king, and the Egyptian priest of the false gods. But so we have here the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and what do? They come to draw water and to fill the troughs of water for their father's flock. So they are shepherdesses. These shepherdesses coming to the well by which Moses probably lived. That's where he has settled, by the well. And the shepherdesses were driven away by a group of shepherds. Now this is the third conflict that Moses gets into. It seems like he is attracted to conflict for some reason. I don't know. He's like, I'm here in Egypt. Something happens. The next day, here I'm in the middle of an argument again. I go out to the middle of Midian and by this well, and what happens? Well, conflict comes again. It's okay. God's going to use him in some thoroughly complicated conflict in the future. But what does Moses do with these shepherdesses who are driven away from this well? The language is very sweet. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and then watered their flock. And you think about that. Here he is. He's a sojourner in Midian. He sees this injustice taking place. He stands up. He drives the shepherds away, and not only does he, allow these 7 daughters of the priest of Midian to water their flock, but he does it for them. And I think it shows a servant's heart for sure. It's a foreshadowing of what he will do. And then, I love this, when they came home to their father, Reuel. Now, who is Reuel? He has a different name too, right? Do you remember his different name? Jethro, right? Why use Reuel here? It's interesting to think about, isn't it? Well, it's often common that these people would have different names. Reuel means friend of God. So I think it's inserted here on purpose to show us that he was a friend of Elohim, or El, friend of God. How is it? So here he is. The daughters come back early. Right now, you think about this. He's at the house. He's expecting the daughters at, let's say, 4:30 or 5. And here they are. They're coming in at 3:30. And he's like, oh. I think two things is going through his head. well, either something good has happened or something bad has happened, and probably something bad has happened. So what does he say? He says, well, how is it that you have come home so soon today? Look at their answer. They said, and this is how they identify him, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water. Now, the language is very emphatic there against, and he even, can you believe it? Or he drew water for us. Like, that was unfathomable to them. Like, he drew water for us. So, like, so he drove the shepherds away, and then he drew, can you believe he drew water for us? And then Reuel's or Jethro's reaction is even greater. Then he said to his daughters, and I think I'm going to do my own translation, why in the world did you leave him there? Why did you leave him there? Where is he? That he knew that the character of this man was something special. They said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. Verse 20, he said to his daughters, then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. I love this, right? So call him so that he may eat bread. And the text goes really quick from here. So, I mean, what could happen? It's just an innocent meal, right? Well, before you know it, Moses is content to dwell there. That's the same word, set by the well, to dwell. But it's not, it doesn't mean set, it means to dwell there. Moses is content to dwell there, and oh, by the way, he marries a wife, and oh, by the way, he has a son. One single little meal, and that's what happens, right? Well, I got to be careful. That's right. Bring him here, let me feed him, let's see what happens. But it is true. Where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. Verse 21, and Moses was content to dwell with the man. He was content to dwell there. And he gave Moses his daughter, Zipporah, and she gave birth to a son, and she called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. Once again, the name has significance. In view of naming the customs of the Semites, he was most likely referring to Midian as the foreign land, not Egypt. If Egypt had been the strange land, and he now found this place, he could not have given the boy such a name. Personal names reflect the present or recent experiences or the hope for the future. So this naming is a clear expression by Moses that he knows he is not where he is supposed to be. I'm a sojourner, foreigner. I feel out of place. I'm dislocated. God hears Israel, probably the most significant verses of this whole chapter. Verse 23, during those many days, the king of Egypt died. So once we have another death of the king of Egypt, and what happens? The people of Israel groaned because of their slavery, and they cried out for help. For what did the Israel cry out? And who heard their cry for rescue? So the setting changes. Here Moses is, and he's in Midian, and he's a sojourner, and the lights sort of fade on the narrative. And as the lights fade on the narrative, we get a glimpse of what's happening back in Egypt. And the king has died, and the people are suffering, and they're crying out for help. So this is happening over Midian, and then here this is happening here in Egypt. They're crying out for help. Why? Their cry for rescue from slavery, who did it come up to? It came up to God, Elohim. In verse 24, it is so succinct, so clear, so beautiful. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Have you ever cried out? Have you ever groaned because life is heavy and hard? You thought to yourself, I'm alone. What's going to happen? God hears us. Not only does he hear us, he remembers his promises. God loves it when you call upon his name and invoke the promises that he has made. God, you have said you will never leave me or forsake me. Don't leave me now. He loves that. He will come to you so quick if you ask him. He will never, ever not hear you when you cry out to him. I will in no wise cast you out. He remembers his promises and his covenant with Abraham, and he is going to keep that. He has already, in Midian, provided a deliverer. They don't know it yet. They're here in Egypt. They don't know it yet. But there's one over here in Midian by the well, and he is already working to bring deliverance about. God saw the people, and then what? God knows. Don't ever think that he doesn't know. He knows. Father, what a joy it is to have these verses linger in our ears and in our hearts as we go about this week. Lord, I pray that you would orient our hearts to always remember that you are a promise-keeping God. And Lord, that you promised to deliver your people, and you did, not once, but multiple times. Not only have you delivered Israel from Egypt, but you have delivered your children from sin by the gift of your Son. Lord, let us often, often cry out to you in the name of Jesus for help. We ask this in your name. Amen.